I'm Marty Moscoe. Welcome to Radio Times. Israel has resumed airstrikes in Gaza today after first accepting a truce proposed by Egypt that lasted just a few hours. Hamas leadership called the proposal unacceptable and continued to fire rockets into Israel. So far, nearly 200 Palestinians have been killed in Gaza, including civilians, even children, with no Israeli deaths so far. Many more in Gaza have been wounded and displaced. Today, we talk about the roots of this latest round of violence, the internal and external politics exacerbating the tensions and the challenges for restarting a meaningful peace process. Much to discuss in this hour of Radio Times. Our guests are Khaled El-Gindi. He's a fellow with the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership in Ramallah on permanent status negotiations with Israel. This was from 2004 to 2009. And Khaled El-Gindi, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Daniel Kurtzer. He's a professor of Middle East Policy Studies at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School. He served as U.S. Ambassador to Egypt and U.S. Ambassador to Israel, author of several books on the Arab-Israeli conflict, including most recently The Peace Puzzle, America's Quest for Arab-Israeli Peace. And Daniel Kurtzer, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you, Marty.
Daniel Kurtzer, let me begin with you. Is there a military solution to this crisis that we're observing?
No, and that's been proven time and time again. This is not the first time Israel and Hamas have gone at each other. In all of those occasions, 2006, 2008, 2012, and now today, they pummel each other, and then it ends because of either fatigue or international pressure. And there are conditions set up for a ceasefire, but they're only military conditions. They don't involve any political outcome, and therefore there are no grounds to believe that any of them works to contain this in the future.
And what we hear from Israel is they essentially want to defeat Hamas or defeat its military capability. Do you think, Daniel Kurtzer, that's doable?
No, and that too has been proven in the past. Previously, Israel articulated that as a goal, and in this round, it's been more hesitant to say so because I think it understands that Hamas is a movement. It's not a physically located target that you can destroy. And so you can kill Hamas operatives and activists. You can degrade their infrastructure, but at the end of the day, there will be people who continue to believe in what Hamas believes in, and therefore setting that as an objective simply is not attainable.
To you, Khaled El-Gindi, what do you think Hamas wants out of this conflict?
Well, I think, first of all, I agree with what Ambassador Kurtzer has laid out, although I would only point out that in terms of the pummeling, it's been fairly one-sided. It's mostly Palestinians in Gaza who get pummeled. But aside from that, I think... I think Hamas right now is on the ropes. They're weaker than they've been in a very long time. And although I don't think that they were planning for a war, they sort of backed themselves into a corner, and now they have one. I think their primary goal is really survival. And oddly enough, they've calculated that their survival is now, if in fact it's true that they've rejected or are planning to reject the ceasefire initiative, then we have the odd situation where they've calculated that their survival is better secured by continuing to fight than by stopping. And I think, you know, part of that, the answer to that lies in the terms of the ceasefire and also the way it was put out there. It basically contains none of the demands that Hamas has been making, and they weren't even consulted in the process. And according to their spokespeople, they learned about it through the news media, like everyone else. So, from Hamas's standpoint, I think it would be a humiliation. It would look like a surrender, and ultimately, they have to, you know, they're speaking to a domestic audience of Palestinians.
Well, and just picking up on what you said about their survival, Khaled, how is their survival tied to continuing to send rockets into Israel?
Well, I think obviously it's counterintuitive on some level, but if you look at it in the context of internal Palestinian politics, you really have two approaches. One is the approach of Mahmoud Abbas and the path of negotiations and the peace process and peaceful conflict resolution. And that path has failed for now more than 2 decades. And Palestinians, I think, have grown tired of kind of this charade of a peace process. On the other hand, you have Hamas's approach, which is based on armed struggle and resistance, and they're betting that Mahmoud Abbas's approach will fail, and of course it has. And so I think they're looking to capitalize on that a little bit, given their worsened position. And so even though Gaza Palestinians will pay a very heavy price, I think they're looking at the broader Palestinian public that, you know, it's we're dealing in binaries, and so Hamas doesn't have to be successful. It just has to be ever so marginally better than Mahmoud Abbas.
Well, let me go back to you, Daniel Kurtzer. I mean, are we seeing a failure of moderate voices in this conflict?
Oh, for sure. There's, first of all, a failure of leadership, and that applies to everybody. It applies to the Israelis, it applies to the Palestinians, and it applies to the United States, which has played such an active role in peacemaking. But at the end of the day, when the peacemaking didn't succeed, what we did was to walk away. We called a pause rather than to press forward. And you're also seeing a failure in moderate politics. Public opinion polling for many years has shown a strong interest in both communities, Palestinian and Israeli, in a fair and reasonable peace settlement. So it's not as though this is an unattainable goal, but so far that has not been translated into the politics of concluding a treaty or an agreement, and therefore there's room for radicals to step in and start to determine the terms.
So why have the moderates been sidelined?
I think it's leadership. I think at key moments, some Israeli leaders did step forward with ideas that were forward-looking. Palestinian leaders were not ready. Israeli leaders were not ready to go beyond what they had initially offered, and the Palestinian leaders retreated. You had that at Camp David in 2000. You had it again most dramatically in 2008 when the then Prime Minister, Ehud Olmert, put forward a very far-reaching proposal, and Mahmoud Abbas, the president of the Palestinian Authority, was not ready to accept it, largely because Olmert was on his way out of office, having been indicted for a variety of crimes for which he has now been sentenced and convicted and sentenced. So, if leaders don't step forward, the good ideas get lost and the will of the people gets lost. And I think that's what's been happening here.
Hala, do you also think that this was this resumption, I guess, of attacks and violence was as a result of the abduction, the murder of three Israelis, and then the abduction and murder of a Palestinian? Do you see that as the sort of spark that led to the crisis today?
I do. I think particularly the kidnapping and murder of the three Israeli teenagers, which we later found out that they were murdered almost immediately after they had been abducted. I think the massive crackdown that the Israeli army launched in the West Bank in response to that, even though I think it seems clear now that they most likely knew that they were in all likelihood already dead, in that process, hundreds of Palestinians were rounded up. Something like 9 or 10 Palestinians were shot dead by Israeli forces in protests during that crackdown. Hundreds of homes were ransacked. And so Hamas, being at the center of that, bearing the brunt of that crackdown, felt that the only real response they had was from Gaza, which is their base. Again, I don't think that they were planning a war, but they sort of overshot and didn't anticipate, I think each side kind of over-calculated, and, we are where we are today. But, I think it's important to remember that that crisis, in a way, was manufactured. It was largely artificial. If we believe that the Israeli government already knew that the teenagers were dead, and they went about this crackdown primarily as a way to corner Hamas and to ultimately to torpedo the Palestinian Unity Agreement, then very much looks like it was a kind of an artificially created crisis. Certainly, you know, Hamas had up until that point maintained the ceasefire fairly effectively, the ceasefire from 2012. In the tit for tat, things sort of spiraled out of the control of, I suppose, both sides.
Do you see it that way, Daniel Kurtzer?
Well, I think Khaled has captured the issue quite well. The problem is that each side is going to have a narrative about how this started, and neither will convince the other of the validity of its narrative. The Israelis clearly have been interested in going after Hamas for quite some time, particularly Hamas in the West Bank, which may or may not be under the quote-unquote central control of the Hamas leadership. And there are those within Hamas who have been itching for a fight with Israel, even though the Hamas leadership has wanted to maintain the ceasefire. So, you know, the narrative war is as serious in some respects as the actual war on the ground, because there's no point at which these narratives touch. They don't meet, and therefore it's very hard to figure out, who's on first and who's to blame.
Is that because people don't know each other? They don't talk to each other? If you've got these competing narratives, Daniel Kurtzer, that can keep this crisis going.
Well, they certainly don't know each other very well. It used to be that we could say that Palestinians and Israelis knew each other better than any other conflicted group in the world. But today, that's changed. Ethan Bronner had a good piece in the New York Times this past Sunday in which he argued that the separation fence and other forms of separation and isolation have led to a situation where Israelis and Palestinians don't meet other than on the battlefield. Mm. And Israel and Hamas certainly don't meet, except perhaps in intelligence exchanges. But it's very much a situation that's changed over the years, where these two peoples are now falling farther apart than coming together.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. That's Ambassador Daniel Kurtzer. He served as U.S. Ambassador to both Egypt and to Israel. He's currently a professor of Middle East Policy Studies at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School. Also with us, Khaled El-Ghindi. He's a fellow with the Center for Middle East Policy, and that's at the Brookings Institution. He served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership in Ramallah on permanent status negotiations with Israel. This was back in 2004 to 2009. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation talking about the crisis in the Middle East involving Israel and Gaza and certainly the West Bank as well. We're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Where do we go from here? Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Support for WHYY comes from Beck Institute for Cognitive Behavior Therapy. Dr. Judith Beck and Dr. Aaron Beck welcome new clients to their Center for Psychotherapy in Bala Cynwyd. Beck Institute is committed to providing effective, problem-focused, and compassionate treatment for issues such as anxiety, depression, stress, and weight management. To learn about cognitive behavior therapy or to schedule an appointment, beckinstitute.org or 610-664-3020.
Next time in Studio 360, musician Andrew Bird shares the secret to his success, not thinking positively.
I do kind of, before a tour starts, imagine the worst happening, which is the bus going off a cliff.
Also a live performance from Andrew Bird and his band next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Way back when, New York City was known for its oysters.
And the average New Yorker, as recently as 1920, ate 600 local New York City oysters a year. Now they eat zero.
We'll talk seafood sustainability with Paul Greenberg next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're talking about the crisis in the Middle East, this one involving Israel and Gaza, and talking with Khaled El-Gindi and Daniel Kurtzer. They have both been involved in past Israeli and Palestinian negotiations between the two sides, joining us to share their perspective on what is happening in this region of the world and what happens next. Where does this crisis go next? And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Khaled, going back to you, where does this leave Mahmoud Abbas? He welcomed the ceasefire. He condemned the kidnappings and murders of the three Israelis. He certainly wants a united government between Fatah and Hamas. An NPR report this morning described him as being very isolated, very unpopular, with a fragile government. How do you see him?
Well, I think that's an accurate description. I think, you know, he has been marginalized even more than he was previously. When his message all along has been peace process and negotiations and, you know, dealing with, you know, trying to resolve the conflict peacefully, obviously when a group like Hamas is engaged in armed attacks, that undermines him. But also what's undermined him, I think, is the behavior of the Israeli government, where, you know, he has been a willing partner for a two-state solution and feels that that hasn't been reciprocated on the other side, where you have an Israeli ruling coalition that openly opposes, its members openly oppose a two-state solution and a Palestinian state. And so, in a way, Mahmoud Abbas is sort of the last true believer in a two-state solution. At the same time, he has, you know, he was already, I think, feeling pressure from within his own ranks, inside his own party, during the negotiations, where most of his inner circle were opposed to going back to the negotiations, seeing them as futile, seeing the Americans as not a credible broker, and of course that was only reinforced. I mean, that perception was reinforced after the collapse of the process. Now add to that mix Hamas's kind of stealing the initiative, and Mahmoud Abbas is being totally unable to have any impact. He's unable to obviously protect his people in Gaza. He cannot move international players. He's not even really, he's being consulted, but he's not the key decision maker in the ceasefire discussions. So he has been, I think, the biggest loser after, obviously, the Palestinian people in Gaza.
Well, Daniel Kurtzer, picking up on that and going back to you, how much do you think the expansion of settlements in the West Bank has hurt Mahmoud Abbas?
Well, there's no question that the settlements issue has been one of the major points of contention, not just during the current peace process, but going back 40 years. Palestinians believe that the land over which they're negotiating is simply being eaten up by unilateral Israeli activities. That said, the reality is that there have been moments in which settlements have slowed down or even been frozen to a point, and even during those periods, progress in the peace process has been very slow. So, yes, settlements are a huge problem, but they're not the major problem. The major problem here is that no formula has yet been found that meets the minimum requirements of both sides. And even though we've come close at various times, I would say, for example, in 2008, we came very close. We still were unable to bridge those last gaps.
And what would that minimal formula include?
Well, for example, I included in one of my recent books a set of parameters or terms of reference that laid out what a final settlement might look like, at least in outline form. Borders that are essentially based on the 1967 lines with equal swaps so that you end up with the equivalent of 100% of the territory, a Jerusalem in which there are two capitals, but unlikely division of the old city and therefore needing some sharing arrangement, very heavy emphasis on security. In other words, you go down the list of 7, 8, 9 of the main topics, and there are ways to figure out how to address these issues. That has not yet happened in the negotiations.
But what's so interesting to me is both you, Daniel Kurtier, and you, Khaled El-Gindi, have been negotiators, and it sounds like you largely agree on a lot of these issues. Sound incredibly reasonable. This is to you, Khaled. I mean, if it didn't work in 2008, what's the chance for any kind of progress today?
Well, obviously, almost none. You know, the talks had already collapsed even before this crisis, and I, in fact, argued that they were doomed from the very beginning. I think failure is sort of programmed into the process, and it's you know, without a kind of radically remaking the process, which would entail a political cost in Israel and the United States, it had no chance of succeeding. But I agree with Ambassador Kurtz's characterization. Basically, what you have is, you know, the two-state solution was never the optimal, was never the best solution for either side. It was always the least worst, I think. And there had always been sort of narrow constituencies or a narrow consensus on, to the extent that there was a consensus on the Israeli side and on the Palestinian side for two states. It was very fragile and I think temporary. And so now what we're seeing is that those consensuses on both sides are falling apart.
So is this, are you talking about a one-state solution?
Well, I mean, there are certainly advocates for that. There are different types of one-state models. There is the sort of egalitarian, binational type that some Palestinians advocate, and there's the not very egalitarian variety that some in the Israeli ruling coalition are beginning to advocate for an annexation, but without giving Palestinians full rights in a single Israeli state, just sort of limited autonomy on a permanent basis. I think we're not, you know, the problem is that the two-state solution remains, I think, the best option. And it's not impossible to, I think, it's theoretically still possible. Realities on the ground can be reversed, but it really will take, it's getting harder every day and every year. So, you know, simply, I agree again with Dan that taking a pause, I think, was a mistake, because it doesn't get any easier down the road. Not in 6 months, not in a year, certainly not in a few years. It only gets harder, and we've seen that reflected in the politics of the two sides, where Hamas has grown in its it's been on the ascendant in the last decade, and also very, very right-wing elements inside Israel have been on the rise and have actually come to power in Israel. So it's possible, but it will take, I think, political will, and it will require an American administration to take a hit politically, which it hasn't been willing to do.
And I want to pick up on that. We have a tweet from Doug, and this is to you, Daniel Kurtzer, says, don't you have to expect violence from an occupied people under siege? I'd be curious about your response to that.
Look, all independence movements have at one point or another engaged in violence. So it's not unusual and it's not unexpected that Palestinians, having been unable to achieve their objectives through negotiations, might take up violence. But that doesn't really answer the question of whether or not the negotiations themselves were fated to fail. And what Khaled said was very important, which is that there's no reason that these negotiations are fated to fail. It's a matter of political will and determination. And so far, frankly, that's been missing on all three sides. Certainly the parties themselves have not manifested. And I don't think our administration, either the current administration, certainly not the Bush administration, which ignored this process for 8 years, or even the Clinton administration, which became so engaged at the end, but was engaged in a kind of awkward, almost one-sided fashion. We have not run this peace process well for almost 20 years, and we can do better.
And that's Daniel Kurtzer, served as U.S. ambassador to Egypt and to Israel, author of several books about the Arab-Israeli conflict, including the most recent one called The Peace Puzzle. And he's a professor at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School. Khaled El-Gindi is a fellow with the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, and he served as an advisor to Palestinian leadership 2004 to 2009. We have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. I'm hearing a little bit of a feedback in my headphones, but I will let our engineer take care of that. Daniel Kurtzer, let me go back to you. And does Egypt feel like the right broker for a peace process? They put something on the table. It was accepted at first by Israel and then rejected. And it seems unclear. Hamas seemed to have divided opinion about it. But is Egypt the right broker?
You know, Marty, this weekend, some Hamas spokesmen suggested that Egypt was not the right broker. They talked about Qatar or Turkey, and that probably reflects a bit of anxiety about the direction of Egyptian policy after the role of the military in ousting former President Mohamed Morsi. So it may have been almost fated that an Egyptian role here would have been rejected by Hamas. I think also the way the Egyptians did this, kind of putting it out publicly without prior consultations, kind of messed up Hamas's already very challenged organizational style. You know, they have an organization that is spread over external leadership and Gaza leadership and West Bank leadership. So it's hard enough for them to deal with questions when they're presented in an organized way, let alone when they're confronted with something that hits them from the press. So it may be that we would be looking for an alternative mediator, probably some combination of Qatar and Turkey, with the United States coming in order to deal with Israeli concerns.
Would that move things in a positive direction, Khaled? Okay, I'm sorry. We got it. We have to get him back. I'm sorry. I think we're going to get him back on a line. But I wonder to you, though, Daniel Kurtzer, whether the U.S. is the right broker in that we are an ally of Israel, a very generous ally, if I might say so, and certainly have supported this country. We have a conflicting relationship, I would say, with Hamas, and a difficult, or at least an unresolved relationship with Mahmoud Abbas. So is the United States the right broker?
Well, it can't be done only by the United States for the reasons you just suggested, Marty. We don't have a relationship or even a dialogue with Hamas. But it also can't be done without the United States, because at the end of the day, to the extent that Israel is going to trust any interlocutor, any intermediary, it will trust the United States. And so if you look back at the model of 2012, where the Egyptians started the ball rolling at that time, but you remember that Secretary of State Clinton at that time had to travel back to the Middle East from the Far East in order to deal with the Israeli concerns. And that may be the model that's followed now, depending on who the other intermediary is, whether it's Turkey, Qatar, or whoever.
What do you think, Khaled?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I agree completely that the United States, you can't exclude the United States. But at the same time, I think part of the problem has been the total monopolization of the United States of this process, and that's just not tenable. Time and time again, we are shown that we need the involvement of other actors. Case in point, Egypt in this ceasefire discussion, as well as previous ones, as well as other stakeholders, both in the region and elsewhere. The problem has been that the United States has sort of compartmentalized the process in a way so that the Egyptians are called in when we need a ceasefire in Gaza because, as Dan said, we can't talk to Hamas. The EU is called in when we need some project to be funded. The You know, the Arab states are called in when you need to pressure the Palestinian leadership to do something. But it's the United States that sort of runs the show, and it has not been well managed, as Dan has said. And I think the only way it can succeed is for the United States to give up some of that political control over this process and bring in other stakeholders. There's simply no way around that. I think the United States, everybody understands, has a special relationship with Israel, and there is that's not entirely compatible with being an even-handed broker. When you're, you know, when push comes to shove, even Israeli positions that we may not like, we end up having to back, if only because of our own domestic politics.
Well, I wonder, too, picking up on that, Daniel Kurtzer, whether U.S. domestic politics has tied the U.S.'s hands in trying to broker some kind of meaningful peace negotiation.
Well, the easy answer is yes. It's hard to discuss anything controversial about a situation involving Israel in Washington. But if you dig a little bit more deeply, when the executive branch, when presidents have acted forthrightly, and when their policies have been reasonable and fair, even when they have involved some problems in the relationship with Israel, Congress will normally step aside. They may, you know, play from the angles, and they may try to constrain the president a little bit. But even the Congress, and I would suggest even this divided Congress, would yield to the president if there was a strong and determined U.S. policy. One of the test cases, Marty, is going to be, for example, on Iran, where we may end up with an agreement either around July 20th or sometime thereafter. And it's going to be an agreement that the state of Israel is going to have problems with. But I think this administration is going to be determined enough to push this thing forward and to win the argument in Washington, because the agreement, any agreement we sign, will be an agreement that's fair and reasonable.
Even this Congress and this president, Daniel Kurtzer?
Even this Congress and this president. I know it runs against the grain of the current thinking about partisanship and the partisan divide. But, you know, I would stake out a position on this one that Iran's going to prove the point that, if the policy has to be reasonable and fair. It has to meet our basic needs. It has to take into account the needs of our allies, including Israel. But it's not going to meet Israel's needs 100%, and yet, nonetheless, I think the president's going to be able to win it.
And again, that's Daniel Kurtzer, who joins us along with Khaled El-Gindi, and we are talking about Israel and Gaza, the West Bank, the United States, and again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Hi there, I'm Gian Gomeshi, the host of Q. Tune into Q each day for your dose of arts, culture, and entertainment, from live music and feature chats with compelling cultural figures to debates on the issues of the day. Q has got you covered. That's coming up from PRI, Public Radio International. Weeknights at 9, beginning August 4th on WHYY.
To survive her husband's 8 deployments, 4 to Iraq and Afghanistan, Angela Ricketts developed what some military spouses call the black soul, a soul that's become increasingly detached and hardened from goodbyes. During his deployments, she was home raising their 3 children. On the next Fresh Air, Ricketts talks about her new memoir describing life as an infantry wife. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Talking the talk or keeping the faith.
We got Obama, and it's wonderful, but it is not going to address the structural problems that exist in the black community, which he has done practically nothing.
Symbolism versus action in President Obama's approach to race. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. Our guests Khaled El-Gindi and Daniel Kurtzer have both been involved in negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians. El-Gindi is a fellow at the Brookings Institution, served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership in Ramallah. Daniel Kurtzer served as U.S. ambassador to Egypt and to Israel during his 29 years in the U.S. Foreign Service. And that's what we're talking about in this hour of Radio Times. Calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Chris from Ballykinwood to join our conversation. Chris, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I have a question. If I understand my history correctly, it was the Yom Kippur War at that time that Israel acquired the West Bank, Golan Heights, and in addition to that, the Sinai Peninsula from Egypt, and controlled it for a while. If a two-state solution is something that's being considered, right now it would be fragmented, wouldn't it, between the West Bank and Gaza. Was there ever consideration, or was it ever feasible to think of Sinai as becoming Palestine? I mean, Israel displaces Palestinians anyway. Was that ever on the table, or was that just totally unrealistic?
Chris, let me toss that to Daniel Kurtzer. Can you answer that?
Yeah, first on the history side, it was actually in 1967, that war in which Israel acquired these territories the course of the conflict. The answer is no. The idea has never been given serious consideration, although it has surfaced. And the reason is that the Palestinians see Palestine as their homeland and are unwilling to accept an alternative. There was an idea put forward, at least informally, a few years ago, to quote-unquote compensate Palestinians for Israel's retaining some parts of the West Bank and Gaza by Egypt's giving over some part of Sinai, but even that was rejected. This conflict, to the extent that it's going to be settled, will have to be settled within the territorial boundaries of historic Palestine, where both Israel and the Palestinians claim territorial rights as part of their homelands.
Thanks for the call. We have a tweet from Holtzman. This is to you, Khaled, saying Israel is a country based on democracy. Hamas is a terrorist group. Is he right about that?
Well, I think both the terms democracy and terrorist are sort of loaded, and they can be very easily thrown around. Clearly Israel is a democracy for its overwhelming majority of its Israeli Jewish citizens. I think Palestinian citizens of Israel maybe don't benefit as much from Israeli democracy in every respect, and they feel that they're second-class citizens. But also, I think the question of Israeli democracy is complicated by the fact that you have roughly half of the population that lives under Israeli rule have no citizenship rights of any kind and are essentially stateless, and yet Israel rules over them. So I think this is the question that Israel has to grapple with about its future. As far as Hamas, yes, Hamas has carried out terrorist attacks. They've attacked civilians. They're reprehensible. And in fact, you know, as Dan pointed out earlier, almost all liberation movements have, in one way or another, engaged in violence, including, by the way, organizations that eventually became the foundation for the State of Israel. Before 1948, several Zionist Jewish organizations were involved in terrorist attacks on Arab civilians and on British authorities who controlled the country at the time. So it's not a question of, I think it's not purely a moral question. Terrorism is always, I think attacking civilians is always reprehensible. The question is whether the political demands can be addressed in an equitable way that meets the needs of both sides.
We have a tweet from ATP, and this is to you, Daniel Kurtzer. I'll just read the end. When will the moderates step up? We were talking about the role of moderates. Do you feel like they are still on the sidelines, or is there an opportunity for moderates to step up and help resolve some of what we've been talking about?
Well, you know, the political space for the moderates continues to shrink in both societies. There was a very large peace camp in Israel up until perhaps the second Palestinian Intifada in the early 2000s, and that began to shrink under the weight of that Intifada. There's always been a moderate Palestinian center, but here, too, they're being squeezed between the failure of negotiations on the one side, as Khaled indicated earlier, and the radical action taken by groups like Hamas or Palestinian Islamic Jihad on the other side. So there is a race against time here for that moderate center to both hold and expand, and so far it hasn't worked very well.
Let me get to Monica from Brewerytown to join us on Radio Times. Monica, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. I have two questions for your guest. I was wondering whether Palestine was acknowledged as an independent state by United Nations in 2013. And also, what is the European Union policy towards the current crisis?
Monica, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Khaled, do you want to take that first?
Sure. The status that Palestinians achieved in 2013 was that of a non-member state recognized by the United Nations. Initially, Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian president, sought formal recognition as a member state, as a full member state of the United Nations. That would have required, I think, Security Council action, and so with the United States completely opposed, that wasn't going to happen. And so essentially they forced a vote at the UN General Assembly that recognized the state of Palestine as a non-member of the United Nations, which then opened up membership to other international organizations. As far as the... Do you want me to take the second question
also? Sure, go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
Which was on... remind me.
How the EU looks at this
situation.
Oh,
the EU, that's right. The EU has always been kind of a secondary actor in this process. They've tended to take positions that are slightly more accommodating toward the Palestinian side than the American position, slightly more balanced. But I think in this particular crisis, there isn't really much difference between the American position and the European position.
Daniel, I'm curious, you had mentioned U.S. negotiations with Iran, but I'm thinking about, I don't know if it's civil war yet, but certainly the crisis in Iraq, the civil war in Syria, all the unrest in this part of the world. How do you think that is changing or influencing what is going on between Israel, Gaza, and the West Bank?
Well, in big policy terms, it obviously all has an impact, because this is a region that has suffered from very serious problems for many years, and almost all of those problems are now surfacing at the same time. It's almost a perfect storm of a combination of the lack of legitimacy and corruption and authoritarian politics and you name it.
Yeah.
So all of that has an impact. As far as the United States is concerned, I think what this administration has tried to do is to begin the process of defining exactly where not only our interests are at stake, but where we can make a difference. And I'm not sure that there's any consensus in Washington to do much more than what we're currently doing in Iraq, even though our interests are at play, as opposed to Iran, where not only are our interests are at stake, but we can actually negotiate an agreement that might turn the nuclear program around. So there's a kind of sophistication of policy choices here, which, it'll be interesting to see how it plays out.
And to you, Khaled, I mean, looking at this crisis involving Gaza and West Bank and Israel, what do you see as at least some steps out of the current situation?
Well, I think one of the problems has been one of the kind of structural problems in managing this process has been that the United States has tended to treat Gaza conflicts and these flare-ups in Gaza between Hamas and Israel as sort of a separate conflict from the Israeli-Palestinian conflict or as separate from the peace process. So, you know, dealing with Mahmoud Abbas in negotiations and at the same time working with Egypt and others to deal with Gaza separately. The reality, of course, is that there is one conflict. Gaza and the West Bank are both areas that have to be part of a future Palestinian state under a unified government of one sort or another. And so I think one thing that the United States ought to have done much more forcefully than it has is to support a Palestinian reconciliation. You know, national cohesion and unity is not just in the interest of the Palestinians, but, you know, having that one authority, one address that can have both legitimacy and the ability to function on the ground effectively is also in the interest of Israel and the United States and the peace process as a whole. So I think we ought to sort of focus on finding ways to put, you know, Humpty Dumpty back together again, which admittedly is very, very difficult given the current violence and the current crisis.
And to you, Daniel Kurtzer, what do you see as a possible first step out of this crisis?
Well, I think Hal is right. First of all, you have to look at Gaza in context. Certainly, you want to stop the immediate violence. Palestinians in Gaza are suffering, as are large parts of the Israeli population that are now living under the threat of rocket attacks. So, you have an immediate question here of stopping the violence. But the larger question is, how do you reintegrate Gaza into this larger Israeli-Palestinian context? Part of that is going to be a kind of Gaza stabilization plan in which the Gaza economy can be rebuilt, the infrastructure that's been destroyed can be reconstructed, but also to reintegrate Gaza and the West Bank as one entity with which Israel would try to negotiate peace. And there are ways to do that. Again, it just requires the leadership and the energy to decide that this is an important priority.
That includes opening borders, yes?
Well, it would certainly include outlets for Gaza, both to Egypt, presumably to Israel as well. Maybe the reconstruction of the Gaza port and airport with security built in. There are ways to do this, but it requires political will.
Let me get to Isaac from University City to join our conversation. Isaac, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome.
This is a question for both Khaled and Daniel. I was just wondering, you have two completely different narratives from the Israeli and the Palestinian side. The Israeli side seeing Israel as sort of this safe haven, both from, as the majority view, safe haven from the Holocaust, anti-Semitism that was given to them by the United Nations. You have Palestinians seeing this as their ancestral home, which is in a way being usurped by the Israelis. And I was just wondering if you think, A, it would be possible to change the narrative at all, and B, if not, whether or not a real lasting peace could exist with both conflicting narratives.
Isaac, it's a great question. Khaled, I'm going to toss it to you, but Daniel, I'd like to hear from you as well. Getting back to this notion of these powerful narratives.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very important point and one that hasn't really been addressed in past mediation efforts or peace processes. The psychological component of a conflict, I think, is always front and center. It's how one side not only sees its own history and narrative and legitimacy, but also the prism through which they look at their enemy. And the two, of course, are mutually reinforcing. And it's been given short shrift. I think it's not necessary to agree on a common narrative, but I think it's necessary to at least agree that there is an alternative narrative and that it's possible to live with the other side even though they have a different narrative. There is, I think, going to have to be some sort of reckoning of the past, and I think, you know, narratives are important, but you know, it's not strictly a question of narratives. For example, the issue of Palestinian refugees, which has largely been neglected in the negotiations, is both a question of narrative, but also a question of rights and of practicality. I mean, there are people who live in conditions both inside and outside the territory of historic Palestine that are, you know, quite bad and who are stateless. You know, I think it's not incidental to the current crisis, for example, that 70% of Gaza's population are refugees.
You know, Colin, I hate to do this to you, only because I want to give Daniel Kurtzer a chance to respond to Isaac's question, and we're almost out of time. But Daniel Kurtzer, go ahead.
You know, what's interesting, Marty, is that you have not so much conflicting narratives, but parallel narratives. Almost mirror images. I've done this in classroom of kind of listing the narratives of the two sides, and then you look at it when you stand back, and both of them talk about injustice and dispossession and attachment to land, and they're almost the same verbiage. I don't think there's a way to bridge narratives so much as to understand them. A textbook came out last year written by an Israeli, Palestinian, and Egyptian scholars that, in fact, tries to do that, lays out the narratives of the two sides, and then tries to come up with some ground on which they both can live without trying to undermine one or the other narrative.
Well, my thanks to both of you for helping us think through and talk about this difficult situation. Daniel Kurtzer, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Marty.
And Khaled El-Gindi, thank you very much as well.
Oh, you're welcome.
And you can go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program, including podcasts and Facebook, Twitter, email, and the archives. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.